Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can support us on Anchor. You can listen to us on iTunes, Google Music, and Spotify at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at 16mm Crew Podcast and on Instagram at 16mm Crew. So this week we watched The Tragedy of Macbeth 2021. It stars Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand and it's directed by Joel Coen. It also stars like a lot of really great black actors. Sean Patrick Thomas, who I have not seen since Save the Last Dance. I was so excited to see him in this movie. And also Corey Hawkins, who was in The Heights. And he was also in a couple of other things. Shout out Compton, I think, was in that too.
Moses Ingram, she was in The Queen's Gambit as well.
Yes, I knew I recognized her face. So, yeah, I just throw that in there because I was like, listen, haven't seen these people in a minute. Anyways, here is the synopsis for the movie. A Scottish lord becomes convinced by a trio of witches that he will become the next king of Scotland. His ambitious wife will do anything to support him in his plans of seizing power. Okay, what did we think? Dale, start us off.
You know, I'm a theater. I like theater. So anytime you're dealing with like Shakespeare, any way, shape, or form, I'm down for it. And we've had like. Shakespeare is probably one of the most reproduced works as far as his plays and stuff being adapted into modern day. I mean, in the 90s, we had like repeated movies, all of them, some for some odd reason, all starring Julia Stiles, like 10 Things I Hate About You, mm-hmm. Oh, Save the Last Dance, that's all Shakespeare. Yeah, I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the changes from the usual that they did. Yeah, for me, being liking Shakespeare and liking that kind, all that kind of stuff, I enjoyed the movie a lot, especially the performances from these like big actors.
Yeah, this was so good. Like Shakespeare for me is like always. It depends on how you do it for me because like I know for most people like the language is kind of hard to get over, and that could have been the case in this situation as well because. Nothing is abridged, like it is straight up like from Shakespeare from the 1600s or whatever, like whenever he wrote this, like it's very difficult language to kind of get around. So I understood it from context, like I didn't understand everything that was going on when they were talking. I think the benefit of this is the visual language, which kind of helps you understand what the story is about even if you don't understand the actual words. So I think Joel Coen did an amazing job on that. Also, the cinematographer, the production design, oh my God. Can I tell you that the way that this movie looked, like this was one of the best looking movies I've seen this year. And I know it's only January, but the statement still stands. Like this movie looks incredible. Like the black and white lend itself so much to this story. And the way the architecture was, it felt modern, even though it was taking place, like it's an older, one of the most like well-known Shakespearean plays, like everything just looked fantastic. Like it just looked great and it was off-putting and it was weird and it was creepy, but it was also really intriguing. And I was just like, yo, this movie looks amazing. And every single actor, and I do mean every single one, like not just Frances and Denzel, obviously they blew the house down, like their performances. It's obvious, like, you're not going to get those two actors and you're not going to get, like, a good performance. It was phenomenal. But I mean every actor, whether they were supporting cast or they had, like, one line, they were so good. Like, everybody was so good. And I haven't seen a cast that was so, that where everyone's performance was so well done. Like, I haven't seen that in a minute. So that was, like, that very much blew me away.
Like what you're saying before, I do agree. Like they leaned heavy into that little horror surrealist, like that whole, like the cinematographer, I think, interview he spoke how they tried to lean in heavily to the whole German impressionism period. German expressionism period. It's really dark and moody, like black and white. Like the architectural style in the film, like you mentioned, in sort of set design is very minimalist. Mm-hmm. And so you're stuck with a lot of heavy blacks and whites on characters' faces that really, you know, like in certain scenes, you don't really get to see their facial emotion, which when dealing with Shakespeare and not translating into a more up-to-date modern English, you rely more on these actors' expressions to understand what they're saying. But when you, those scenes are shrouded in shadows and you're not really understanding 100% what they're saying, it sells it even more as far as the mystery of what's of their actions. And once you see them enter the light and you see that, you know, how the shadows fall across half their faces, you know, the whole transformation of them from dark to light really helped with this movie. And the fact that they made the set so minimalist and not, they went for, we're going for, instead of trying to be theater on a film set, we've seen them do it, like the Coen brothers do that a lot with, you know, of course, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Hail Caesar. Those are really odes to classic Hollywood and done up, like, full of color and vibrance. But this time it took a step back and put you in that whole real surrealist horror mindscape, which I think they did a better, because the focus of this was so much minimal, I think it did a better job in this than in Lighthouse in a way. Whereas Lighthouse kind of traps you in one location, the fact that you have the walls are bare here and there's nothing with them interacting with, like in a scene there might just be a bed and that's it, you know, the barrenness of this set really helped put you in a really claustrophobic, and also the whole the Academy ratio, you know, the 4x3 having in that box, and then also having these characters in another box in some of these shots where they're just framed up in a square really felt that claustrophobic horror kind of thing. This whole dream of, you know, that breakdown into his, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? His trip into, descent into madness, you know, Macbeth. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's, I like that because sometimes when you're trying to portray someone who's like slowly losing their mind, it doesn't always work because I think sometimes it's overdone or something like that. But for in this case, it was visually, you can see him, Denzel, losing his mind. But you also, as the audience, felt like you were losing your mind because of how it was lit, how it was shot, like, because it was in black and white, you didn't know what was day and what was night. So you, everything was kind of just like smushed together. The time of like when, how long has he been king? We don't even know. Like it's just been, it's like a very weird like coming together where you don't really know what's real and what's not. And so to make the audience feel that way, but also to show that this is also how Macbeth is feeling, was, again, Joel Coen is a fantastic filmmaker. Like this was so well done, like executed. It's funny, the lighting person, the lighting director said that he lit it in like a theater type of lighting. He said he didn't use any like kind of movie lighting for this, which is good because it definitely felt like I was watching a play. Like it did, like, because there wasn't like a lot of locations and stuff, and everything was done on sound stages, it did feel like you were kind of watching a play live. But then you had all the VFX and all the other stuff that kind of comes into it to make it a cinematic experience. So to have the feeling of theater but the experience of cinema, like, that's really a talent. Like I don't know what else to say, because that was amazing. Like, to be able to have that duality and just do it, it's just executed so well. Like, you can tell that everyone prepared and everyone, like, was very passionate and was like, we're going to give 1,000% to make sure that this is a great movie, and it was.
Yeah, and it's a credit to them, you know, unlike the States, you know, here for us, where a lot of our actors, you know, start out on TV or nowadays online, in England, in Europe, they start out literally on stage and on theater. So to have that wealth of knowledge from these actors, like the only, I think, American person I think in this cast might have been Corey Hawkins, Denzel, Francis, but to have a lot of actors who have that a stage knowledge and presence, who understand you are molding more through your physical than through your verbal, was great. I mean, of course, you know, Denzel's background in Broadway and theater, you know, Frances McDormand also has one. She actually played in Macbeth in 2016, in the Berkeley Theater, as playing as Lady Macbeth and a weird sister. So she does have that background understanding of the characters. So I do think when these actors come from that kind of theater background, it helps sell these roles a lot more. Because I couldn't imagine seeing Matthew McConaughey or Ben Affleck or whatever in those kind of actors in the role playing Lord Macbeth, and it work as well as Denzel's did, you know. Definitely. And Denzel has a gift for good monologues and stuff like that. So even if you don't understand it, dang, Denzel, you're really doing it. So
yes. Yeah. And it was good to not see him in, you know, the roles that he's always taking, like a cop or a detective or something. It was good to see him in one of these kind of roles, because I know he did Much Ado About Nothing, but I think he actually did another Shakespeare play, way back in the day, Shakespeare in the Park or something like that. So, he is classically trained to do it.
Yeah.
So it just made sense for him. And that Frances and Denzel duo, loved it so much. They play so well off of each other. It was so good to watch. I was eating it up. He was just eating up all of their performances. And especially because a lot of those are monologues, you're not acting with anyone else, so you really do have to carry it. And they can do it. They're really great at it. Love them.
There was a scene where after, you know, Denzel, he kills, I mean, if you don't know Macbeth, we're not really spoiling anything, it's Macbeth. Right after he kills the King of Scotland, and then he shows up in the next day, apparently, and you see that facial struggle of, I'm trying to not show my hand, of not, you know, giving away the fact that I killed the king, and then the next scene where, you know, Corey Hawkins comes down crying about the king being dead, Denzel runs upstairs and he's able to play that utter horror and shock, oh my gosh, that is a really good, because a lot of actors struggle sometimes in these movies of playing their hand of I'm the murderer and still annoying like they're not. Mm-hmm. You see Denzel's character actually do that whole confusion, struggling how to do, you know, in his facial features, how to pretend that he did it, but still trying to fight the guilt, you know, which I did like.
Yeah, I like that. I like all his scenes, especially with him and the witches. Because, you just see his real descent into madness, but it feels so real to him that it feels real to me. I'm like, oh, okay, see what's going on here. You are a mess, but also, that desire for power, and then also just having someone like his wife, Lady Macbeth, who was just encouraging him to just... encouraging his demons. She's not saying no. She is saying, you need to be a man and do this. So that was interesting. But also to see her lose her mind too, eventually. That was also interesting. Frances, fantastic. That was great. I love watching her. She's just so... she's subtle. She doesn't do a whole lot, but yet it's still affecting. And then when she does do a lot, you feel it even more. It's so... it's so good. I'll never get over it. And also, costumes go crazy. Because it's in black and white, you can't, really see, what these things look like. All the textures and stuff they use to, really bring out what the costumes are and to show out their, rise to kingship and queenship. And the hair and everything. Everything just, it just worked. It just really worked. And to your point about the lighthouse, I feel like this did kind of do it. Not that it did it better, because I don't want to compare the two, because I just feel like they're two different things. They have two different objectives of what they're trying to show. But I feel like in terms of, I don't know, making the surrealist parts of it more realistic for me as an audience member, I feel like this did it in a more convincing way. Because in The Lighthouse, they were just showing some really weird stuff, and you were like, ew, what? But in this one, it was just more like, oh, okay, now I see what this is doing to your brain, and, I feel it too. I don't know. It felt more affecting in this one.
Yeah, I think for Lighthouse, what it did, it showed you two characters undergoing mental, the whole breakdown, whereas with this movie, because of, like I said, all of it is really minimalist, and you're just focusing on just actors, it puts you more in the scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In a way. So, I mean, they're both good movies. They both, you know, sought out to do what they did to do. But, you know, one did some things better than the other one, you know? You know, of course, you know, Lighthouse did probably a better job of doing the whole mythological side and that whole, you know, Lighthouse Sailors, they delved more into the mythological side of that. Whereas, you know, with Macbeth, they did a delve more into, you know, that Arthurian, you know, tragedy of honor and morals and the loss of that because, you know, the whole knightly, kingly, you know, grace of honor and stuff was a big deal. So Macbeth is going to focus more on those kind of mythological breakdowns in a way. So.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a
guess. You know what movie this reminded me of watching? It reminded me of Vice.
Interesting. Explain.
Okay, so the reason why I say Vice is because, you know, this movie is slowly driven on, like, the story of Macbeth is slowly driven on the fact that Lady Macbeth wanted the power. And she kind of forces, you know, Lord Macbeth in the situation he doesn't want. It reminds me of Vice and the fact that in watching Adam McKay's movie, we kind of see Lynn Cheney kind of push Dick into a situation he doesn't want, and hence why the country might be the way it is. But that's why it reminded me of watching, you know, Vice and watching her character kind of force Amy Adams, kind of force Christian Bale's character to do stuff he didn't want to do in a very forceful manner.
I think they do a little Shakespearean thingy in the middle of one of their scenes, actually. So yeah, I think, yeah, I get that. I feel it. But yeah, if there isn't any extra things to add, I think we can rate this movie.
I'm gonna give it a 9 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
For me, like I said, love the performances, love the whole, the set design, cinematography, everything, A1. My only criticism is with adapting, it's not even adapting Shakespeare. The issue is, because it's not a really adaptation, Shakespeare is hard to understand because the language it was written in. I do think they could have probably put a more concerted effort in a way to try and, you know, modernize the language a little bit more. But, you know, because you end up with, like I said before, Must You Do It Up, nothing where it's a good movie, but you really don't understand what's kind of going on in a way. If they had actually, you know, probably helpful to other people, you know, use actual modern English. I don't want to feel like I'm reading King James Bible, you know, on screen. But, you know, that's a personal critique. I still loved it anyway, but I feel like a casual movie person who hears that Denzel is in a movie and they go watch this, why they might be turned off because they don't really understand what is being said. So, yeah, but for me, it's a 9 out of 10. So.
Yeah. I'm going to give this movie a 9.5 out of 10. I thought it was just beautifully executed and the performances were just phenomenal. But I will agree and say that the language, the ye olde English language, really does put a barrier between you and what's the story. Like, you can't really get into it if you can't really understand what people are saying. And because dialogue is so much of what this story is, that part is kind of important. Like, I know that they chose to do it for a specific reason, but I feel like it would have been better and more beneficial if they would have just did the abridged version so we could understand what's going on. Because when I was seeing reviews on Letterboxd, the people I was seeing were like giving this movie like 2 stars because they couldn't understand what was being said. And I'm just like, yeah, but also, like, the good outweighs the bad in this case. But I get, if you are, like, a regular viewer, this wouldn't be the movie for you because you don't know what they're saying. So, for that reason, it's not a 10 out of 10. If they would have changed that, it would have been. But, yeah, that's my score.
I mean, we'll probably see more people comment on that, more casual people. people who watch movies, mm-hmm. especially during Oscar season, like award season, because even though you're not like a movie person, everybody wants to say, oh, this person, oh, that movie was trash, this movie was trash, without really. So I feel like if Denzel or Francis or this movie gets any kind of like cinematography, it's gonna get me up there for cinematography, no doubt. And this movie wins for those reasons. Everybody's like, oh, but this movie made no sense because I don't understand what you're saying. You're gonna hear a lot of those kind of critiques, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and you have to accept it because it's like, well, they're not movie people, so you can't expect them to, you know. But that's okay.
You know, this movie really works on selling you the body language. Like, body language helps you a lot with this movie, especially the way it's formatted. And if you can't pick up on what's going on purely based on body language and literally context clues and certain things they're saying, like how you function in everyday life. So,
I was trying to give y'all, whoever out there didn't get it, I was like, you know, it's all right. I was like, no, you're just dumb.
Okay, so many things in life, you going around a day-to-day basis, you interact with people, so much is not said, it's communicated by language. If you don't have a problem understanding it, then why is it an issue when you're watching it on screen? Like, for some reason, when people go into movie theaters, they solely rely on their hearing, not
music. I still recommend that people watch it because I feel like it's kind of the same thing with like international films where people don't want to watch it because they need subtitles and stuff. I feel like don't close yourself off to the experience just because it's in a language that you don't understand. You should still open yourself up to the experience because you're still going to get a lot from it, I think. And also just from the progression of events, you can figure out what's going on too. So
broaden your entertainment palette.
Yes, moral of the story. So anyways, let's move on to the news.
On to the news. Of course, we're gonna kick it off with the box office. Cindy, guess what happened? Finally
I know what happened.
Scream finally is a movie, finally dethroned Spider-Man from the number one spot. Scream, you know, the franchise reboot, horror reboot, finally Spider-Man, which is going to happen eventually. I'm not surprised that it was Scream in a way, you know.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Well, it's really crazy because it's like the fifth Scream movie. Scream hasn't been like a cultural thing since like the 90s, early 2000s.
Right.
The last time Scream was relevant was like the Was Up commercials, and that was it, or the character of Ghostface or whatever. But yeah, which is weird. It first movie debuted in 1996. Wes Craven, and now it's like 25 years after, and three horrible sequels that is finally back, and it took it on the spot, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Spider-Man took the runner-up spot. With the numbers though, dropping down to 10, Matrix Resurrections, 9 holding at 9 spots, steadily is Licorice Pizza. Down one spot from 7 to 8 is West Side Story. American Underdog drops from 5 to 7. Belle debuts at number 6. Of course, Belle is kind of like a virtual high school world. It's a G-Kids production. It's kind of weird, but debut at number 6. Kingsman went from 4 to 5. The 355 went from 3 to 4. Sing 2 is now at number 3. Spider-Man, of course, as I mentioned earlier, was dethroned from number 1, is out number 2, and Scream is number 1 with $30.4 million grossing this weekend. But of course, still looking at a box office so far this year is Spider-Man with a total gross of almost $700 million. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Globally, not all the numbers are in yet. In the United Emirates, Scream is number 1. But in Mexico, South Korea, Brazil, Australia, France, Germany, the UK, Spider-Man is still holding strong there at the number 1 spot. In China, the number 1 movie is Matrix Resurrections. And in Japan, Spider-Man is number 1 as well. So, at least, you know, Spider-Man's holding the number 1 spot internationally still for the time being. Worldwide. Worldwide box office, it was Scream was number 1. So, It is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, surprising. Interesting. Okay. So, filmmaker Joss Whedon has broken his silence on the multiple allegations of misconduct against him from productions he oversaw, including the 2017 film Justice League and his influential TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer. All right, now hold on, I'm gonna get mad. I'm about to get upset. So here he talks to New York Magazine. Gal Gadot alleged that he threatened her. He threatened her career while she was working on Justice League. And so Whedon said, "I don't threaten people. Who does that? English is not her first language, and I tend to be annoyingly flowery in my speech." So when that came out, Gal Gadot responded to that specifically and said, "I understood perfectly." Next, he said that, because obviously Ray Fisher, who played Cyborg, he said that Whedon was gross, abusive, unprofessional, and completely unacceptable. So Whedon said that Cyborg's storyline logically made no sense. And he denied Fisher's allegations, saying that none were true or merited discussing. And then he said, "We're talking about a malevolent, is that how that word's pronounced? Malevolent force? Okay. We're talking about a bad actor in both senses." And so to that, Ray Fisher responded on Twitter today, and he said, "Looks like Joss Whedon got to direct an Endgame after all. Rather than address all of the lies and buffoonery today, I will be celebrating the legacy of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. tomorrow. The work continues."
I find it funny that he chose to speak out against those people in particular.
Mm-hmm.
He ignored a lot of the cast of Buffy, who's probably worked with him the longest.
Mm-hmm.
He ignored Chris McCarpenter's comments. He ignored Melissa Dushku's comments. Sarah Michelle Gellar, David Boreas. He ignored those people.
Mm-hmm.
He ignored those, but he focused just on Ray Fisher and Gal Gadot, and you know, kind of saying, English is not her first language, and he tends to be an underground. That's a slap in the face to anybody in another language who's saying, "Oh, the reason you're basically dumb and you don't know what to say is because you don't speak English." That's
mm-hmm.
Especially if you're talking about somebody like Gal Gadot. You know, yes, some people do have her issues with her, with some of you might be Zionist viewpoints. Still, she is kind of one of the bigger leading ladies in Hollywood at the moment who gets a lot of projects. Kind of say that is like really demeaning and disrespectful to not just her, but to other women in the industry. And to single out Ray Fisher, calling him gross, abusive, and unprofessional, is once again disrespectful to every Black actor you probably didn't interact with.
Mm.
Especially saying that, you know, Cyborg's story didn't make sense. After watching Snyder's movie, we clearly saw that Cyborg's story was literally what was holding the movie together.
Mm-hmm.
It's Cyborg's journey from a hero, from his connection with his father, and learning to be a hero, his father sacrificing himself to save Cyborg, that whole redemption of the father and the son, and then, you know, Cyborg turning around and being the linchpin that saves the world, basically. Hit both him and Flash doing what they gotta do. So to say it didn't make any sense, it just didn't make sense to you. But watching the movie, clearly Zack Snyder knew what was gonna make sense. And he had the vision. He's like, "All this works." But clearly you didn't see that because you were so focused on your own thing. So
yeah, it was pretty disgusting. Honestly, I was disgusted when I read that. I was like, I mean, obviously, when people come at you, your first defense is to defend yourself. Like, you're just going to be like, "No, I didn't do it. Like, no, I didn't say that." And and the other allegations from the people from Buffy, he was just like, "Yeah, I could have handled this better, but no, I didn't call that person fat. And no, I have no idea what that woman's talking about." It's just like, everything he said just proves why he doesn't need to be making movies anymore. Like, that's just it. Like, you don't need to be in this business anymore. This is not the environment for you because you don't know how to treat people. And also, you don't know how to admit when you're wrong. Like, I don't know. I feel like he's one of those men who think that Me Too and all that other stuff is, like, a bunch of crap and that it's just targeting men or some crap like that. But it's just sad because it's like, you are mad disrespectful to Gal, to Ray, to everyone. And you don't deserve to be a filmmaker. Like, you just don't. I don't care if your movies were good. Like, he made the Avengers movie and that was okay. But, like, I don't care anymore. Because I just feel like, who would want to work with someone who is so disrespectful? Like, and then who publicly will say the things that he just said. It's just gross. Like, the man is gross.
The worst, the damning part about this is with Charles Trachtenberg's comment saying that, you know, as a young actress, she wasn't allowed to be alone with him. And he goes, oh, I have no idea what she's talking about because I lived in fear that all my affairs would be discovered. So you're admitting there is a reason why this young lady should not have been left alone with you at all. Like, even goes on, it goes on to mention, like, he had an affair with an assistant on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which he was co-writing. They say that he was paying her almost $2,000 a week just to watch him write over a weekend so she could hide the relationship from their higher-ups. And he goes, his boss said, I could have handled the situation better. What? you clearly, there is a pattern. Michelle could not be left alone with you being young. And you go, that doesn't make any sense because you tried to hide your affairs. And you just proved that you did try to hide your affairs with a 21-year-old, 23-year-old at the time when you're almost 50 years old. So, yes, they were right to not trust her.
Mm-hmm.
And still, even if the woman, Erin Shane, in this case, was 23 and you were almost 50, that still can be deemed as grooming in a way.
Yeah, inappropriate.
Inappropriate. You're grooming her, basically, because she's thinking about, if I don't do this for Josh, whatever, Josh, I'm done in Hollywood, never getting another career. So she's trapped at that moment. So, yeah, Josh, we and you kind of are a piece of shit.
You're trash. Take him out to the garbage. We're done. We're done.
I do think this is one of those interviews where you kind of probably need to have a PR person pre-vet these questions so you don't look like a dumbass, you know? So, yeah.
I'm so glad this came out because it just proves everybody right. Like, everyone who said something about him, it was like, yes, here's the proof that this backs up all your claims.
And he said it himself. Like, mm-hmm. Like, you know, he made it even worse.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the next thing. So, Brian Cox, talks about, you know, Game of Thrones, Pirates of the Caribbean, and Harry Potter. He talks about his decision not to be involved in those things. And you don't know, Brian Cox, of course, is a star of Succession, and he has a memoir coming out with about his roles that he didn't take over his career. He kind of calls Johnny Depp overrated. He says Brendan Gleeson was probably would have been better for Harry Potter. He said he missed out on not committing on a lot of money, basically a money spinner, which makes a money printer, but not committing to those kind of fine franchises because he missed out. He would have missed out on other jobs. He calls like Pirates Caribbean very much a Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow show, which so he's not wrong entirely because Pirates of the Caribbean does feel like it's Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow here, a bunch of other characters, except for the first one. I think the first one, everybody even got it even.
Yeah.
After that first one, it went to focus just on Jack Sparrow. He, of course, was in the running for Mad-Eye Moody and Harry Potter, and Brendan Gleeson got the role. He said it's probably Brendan Gleeson probably did a better job, but he was more in fashion at that stage of his career. I think at this time, Brian Cox had just did X-Men 2. So, I don't know, maybe X-Men 2 is probably the worst out of those original Bryan Singer, well, no, out of the Bryan Singer movies, it's probably the second worst if you don't count Last Stand. So I think his logic is, you know, trying to hand wave why he decided not to take these other lucrative franchise roles in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it worked out ultimately. He's in a really successful show right now, so he's fine. But I thought it was so funny because when I first saw this story, they were talking about him and his comments about Johnny Depp. And he just went in. Like, he was mad disrespectful. Like, not low-key. Like, I mean, what he says is he was just like, I mean, Edward Scissorhands, let's face it, if you come on with hands like that and a pale, scarred face makeup, you don't have to do anything. And he didn't. And subsequently, he's done even less. But people love him, or they did love him. They don't love him so much these days, of course. I was shook.
Kind of an asshole comment.
The shade. Oh, my God. Wow. I was eating that up. I was like, well, this man has no filter, no chill. Like, he just be saying stuff. That's why I kind of love old people, because they just be saying stuff. But I was like, damn.
His choice in these roles also speak out. Of course, he's had over 200 plus, you know, movies to his name.
Mm-hmm.
But the lack of not taking these roles also make it, in a way, harder to get roles, because especially these projects he's speaking out about, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, they push a lot of these actors, you know, into other spots.
Right.
You know, of course, if, you know, the cast of Game of Thrones, almost everybody, top to bottom, still has success. Even though the part of King Robert might have been for one season, and he didn't want to do it because it was only one season, everybody else past that one season got more money in, even if the actors who were only involved in season one still did other projects beyond that. Still got other more money after that. So I don't know. I feel like it's his way of saying, yeah, I missed out on a lot more money because those projects were shit. That's his
defense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean thing. Maybe right. Mm. You know, I'm not gonna say him talking about Johnny Depp. That's low as hell.
Yeah, that's mad mean. That's rude.
But phrasing it as it's, you know, Jack Sparrow show, that was probably correct. But everything else was really an asshole kind of thing.
So, he is on one tonight. Okay. So, The Harder They Fall won Best Picture at the African American Film Critics Association Awards. Yep, they won the top honor, and I think there's the song One Best Music, the one with Kid Cudi and Jay-Z and Tamuel.
Oh, that song that you kind of don't remember? Okay.
I don't even know what the song is. I did not watch the movie, but
oh, I watched it. I don't even remember the song.
So. Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it won Best Music, The Harder They Fall. But yeah. And then also Jennifer Hudson won for Best Actress for Respect. And Corey Hawkins, who was in The Tragedy of Macbeth, won Best Supporting Actor. And Will Smith won Best Actor for King Richard. Yeah. That's what... I didn't really know what these awards were. I didn't know this was a thing until this year. So I'm going to just leave that there, but congratulations, y'all. Y'all got it.
It's another award. It's another plaque, you know. So,
yeah.
So, Amazon and MGM, they signed a big deal with SFX for a Jake Gyllenhaal, Guy Ritchie action movie, which will begin filming this month in Spain. So, it's for not just U.S., but international rights as well. The movie is about, it's kind of untitled, but it's covering the Afghan war. This film is going to start the 24th in Spain, with the rest of the cast members to be announced soon. And it's, I think they're budgeting it for $55 million. Where Jake Gyllenhaal plays Sergeant John McKinley, who's on a last tour duty, where he works at a local interpreter where they're ambushed and whatnot. This is kind of a new thing because it's not just streaming and theatrical, but it's streaming and theatrical deal. It's also formed a studio with MGM, and exchange a distribution model with TXX. So it's gonna, and that's been happening and evolving because the independent landscape with different platforms as far as streaming, streaming has changed and opened up a lot of windows for independent producers. I'm looking forward to this movie to be good. As we've seen, Jake is coming off of Antonio is a Guilty and Michael Bay's Ambulance. We saw success like earlier last year with Guy Ritchie and The Gentleman, which is a very good movie. If you have not seen that movie, go watch The Gentleman. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to do well.
Yeah. And that's our news. So, Dale, what have you been watching?
I watched, of course, you know, Big Bang. I watched a movie called The Gone Committee. It's a story about how, you know, in the medical landscape, there's sometimes committees to help decide who and where gets an organ donation in a near cost, one of the other hours to survive. To decide, but it also jumps backwards and forwards to this moment because there are repercussions from that action. It stars Kelsey Grammer, Julia Stiles, Paulin Domingo, Jimmy Garofalo. Really, really good movie. It goes on, the conversation mostly about is much more important, morals or money. Both Julia Stiles and Kelsey Grammer, they play, a spring fall kind of relationship, both as doctors, but they kind of do have the same viewpoint in the medical field as the more deserving person probably does need it, but they come into conflict with of ethics and everybody else on deciding where it goes. It's a wonderful movie. I when you think Kelsey Grammer, you think Frasier, you forget he's actually a good actor. You remember for your most of the roles, the famous Frasier. That's kind of stuck in your head a lot when you talk about him. I forgot as well how good an actress Julia Stiles is because she's been really low-key last couple of decades. But, you know, of course, her filmography and her list of roles is very strong. The last thing I saw her in briefly, I think, was Silver Linings Playbook. But you forget, like, early in that 90s to early 2000s.
She was that girl.
She was that girl. So it's good to see her in that position to show off her acting skills. And she has another movie coming out, hopefully, comes out next year called Her Orphan First Kill. So, yeah, good to see actors you don't really see anymore acting amazing in roles. So.
I watched Encanto with my best friend. Shout out to Joy. I did not like this movie at all. So, yeah. This movie was so hyped up by you specifically. The only reason I kept hearing about this movie was because of you. And everyone kept talking about that song when you talk about Bruno. So when I heard the song, I was like, this is the song everyone's going off on? Okay, interesting. I didn't like it. I felt like this movie had literally no purpose. Like, there were so many questions about how the magic worked that never got answered. And I didn't really care about any of the characters except for the little boy, the little black boy. He was my favorite. But everyone else, like, I was just like, okay, they had a quirky lead as, like, the lead character because she has glasses on, so she's quirky. And I don't know. I was just like... You know, most Disney movies have, like, a very clear message. Like, when I was watching Luca, it's like, yeah, you may be different and people might not accept you, but you'll find people who do. And it would basically, I mean, they're not going to go out and say, like, this is a gay love story, but basically that's what it was. So that made sense to me. Like, Soul made sense to me, even though, like, most of the time the black man was a cat, which I didn't like. But I liked it enough. Like, I still got what they were saying. This movie, it was just like, be friends with your family and you don't need to have a gift to be special. And it's like, First of all, every child is gifted. Like, every child has, like, every person has something that's unique and special about them. So what are you even saying there? I don't know. It just, none of it connected to me. I was just like, what?
I think you might be focusing too, because you actually really summed up the movie. Right? There's everybody special. Everybody has a gift, whether it's not some amazing, fantastical thing. Everybody's gifted. And I think this movie is more the whole idea of where the magic came from is secondary. The focus is the familial bonds. And somehow it's sometimes stress of family or not thinking you're valuable to family can, you know, put a damper on you. Because a lot of, like this whole pandemic year, like I felt like, you know, oldest son, immigrant family for the most part, I related to Louisa, oldest child, you're the pillar, you gotta hold everything up. But then also, you know, in West Indian communities, you know, the girl, no matter their age, if they're the first girl, they're also that pillar. So I was like, I saw myself in Louisa, and I also saw one of my sisters in Louisa. So it's a really like personal movie if you watch it and you can relate to it, because I related to it a lot. But sometimes I felt like Louisa, sometimes I felt like Maribel, where I'm not special, and blah blah blah. So I mean, I guess it depends. I think it depends on what your mindset is at when you're watching it to develop a connection to it. If you get what I'm trying to say, I don't know.
Yes, no. It's interesting to hear your perspective on it. I just know for me, I was just like, I thought what they were trying to say, because in the beginning of the movie, like her, the grandmother Abuela and her husband, they're trying to like cross the rivers and stuff to get to a better place. And I was like, oh, is this about immigration? Like, okay, we're about to get into that. Like, I'm shocked that we're going to talk about something so serious, but yes, I'm ready for it. But the whole thing was like the house, and then his spirit lives in the candle, and but then they found the magic again, and they found his spirit again, and the magic is in the doorknob now. I was just like, what the heck are you guys even talking about?
I think you focus too hard on the magic side of the movie.
I just feel like, can you make it make sense? Like, can we have some basic rules here, and can we just be consistent with the rules that we're setting up? Like, I don't know, because I was wondering, like, what was the actual issue? Because I thought the issue was, like, oh, the house is falling apart, right? And you need the magic or whatever to keep it together. I thought that was the primary issue. And then later they were like, this is how the house stays together. Her and her sister have to be best friends. And I was like, okay, sure. But then they became best friends, and the house still fell apart. So I was
The magic of the house was a metaphor for the love of the family. Like, the pressure of meeting the grandma's expectations was essentially tearing the house apart, you know?
I did not like this movie.
I love the movie. Like, it's... Especially, I think, more like you're saying before, like, them talking about coming here, finding a better place, and their whole structure of, we have to be here. It's really right. It's very much an immigrant story, because if you have immigrant parents, like, XYZ, like, my parents, like, 50, 60, they're older, because what that mindset is, like, oh, we, you know, come to Jamaica, you got, like, and then we had you guys, you're here now, you know, do XYZ. Mm-hmm. So if you're, like, I think it resonates a lot more people if they come from a background, but, you know, people still have inter-family issues that still, this movie still resonates with, so, I think it depends on your mindset. I think you focus. You said it's a Disney movie about magic. You're just waiting on the magic.
No, I was. It's not even. My thing was like, I wanted to know what the conflict was, because they presented a conflict that the house is falling apart. Yeah. So the thing is, okay, how do we make sure the house doesn't fall apart? And then they're saying, oh, it's about the family and love and accepting one another. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I don't know. It. Maybe the message of it wasn't, it's not that I don't care about the message, because I feel like that is important, but I also just felt like someone just made this because they felt like they wanted to. Like, I don't know. I didn't feel any, like, I didn't feel anything from it. I was just like, okay, great. The songs didn't even hit. I was just like, what is this, man? I talked through every single one of those songs.
You're horrible. Horrible. It's the subtext, man. This movie is like laden with subtext, man.
Okay. Sure.
This is probably one of my more favorite modern day Disney movies. Because I think it's more relatable across the spectrum from every age group. More so than people might say Soul did. Soul, I think an older person would understand Soul a lot more than a younger person. But I do think with this movie, it comes to dealing with inter-family stuff and how you're facing your value. Not just in your family, but in the world. I think it's a universal issue that everybody struggles with.
I like Luca better. That's all I'm going to say on that. Luca was a great movie. And there were no songs in it, thank God. But, like, Luca was great. Anyways, that's it. We hope that you guys are taking care of yourselves and having a good week. Make sure to check out all of our social media. We're going to set up a Letterbox, so make sure you follow us over there to see what we're watching, see some of our reviews for some of the movies that we won't cover on the podcast. And we hope that you're good, and we'll see you in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir, everybody.